Now about our speaker. Michael Mandelbaum is the Christian Herter Professor and Director of the American Foreign Policy Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. He is the author and editor of 25 books on foreign policy and one on sports, titled The Meaning of Sports, Why Americans Watch Baseball, Basketball, Football, and What They See When They Do. A regular columnist for Newsday, Professor Mandelbaum has also served in the office of the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, working on national security issues, and as Associate Director of the Aspen Institute Congressional Project, working with leaders of Congress and exposing them to the latest thinking on American foreign policy. Today, Professor Mandelbaum will be discussing his latest book, The Case for Goliath, in which he outlines his argument that the U.S. acts as a world government, despite the fact that neither America nor anyone else intended it. He explains that even America's most vocal critics, including those in the Middle East, have tacitly accepted the U.S.'s global role by not taking steps to overturn it. Have President Bush's foreign policies and efforts to spread democracy in the Middle East changed the way the world views the United States? And now it is my pleasure to welcome Professor Michael Mandelbaum. Thank you very much for that generous introduction. And let me say first that it is a pleasure and a privilege to be able to address this audience under the auspices of the Middle East Forum, a worthy and important institution, but most importantly, an institution that is increasingly influential. I am well situated to see the forum's influence, living in Washington, working with members of Congress, and working in higher education. And none of these institutions is perfect. All of them could use, can use, improvement, advice, and guidance. And it's a source of personal satisfaction to me to see how the Middle East Forum and its affiliated organizations are making a difference in these important areas of international life. This is a relatively young institution and a relatively small one, but an increasingly powerful one. You don't have to be huge in order to make a difference, and the Middle East Forum does make a difference. Well, let me begin with the subtitle of The Case for Goliath, which is also its thesis, How America Acts as the World's Government in the 21st Century. To call the impact of American foreign policy the world's government is novel and a bit controversial, and yet I think it is justified, indeed valuable, for at least four reasons. First, to call the United States the world's government tells us something important about the world. Specifically, it tells us that advances in the technologies of transportation, communication, and warfare have knitted the world so close together in the 21st century that the world itself, like local and national communities, now requires a degree of governance. Calling the United States the world's government is additionally helpful because it tells us something important about the United States. This country plays, I believe, an historically unprecedented role in the world in the early years of the 21st century. This role is not captured by the familiar terms great power or superpower. A different term is needed, and the term most often proposed to describe what the United States does beyond its borders is empire. But empire, I think, is the wrong term. The United States does not do what empires have historically done. The United States does not engage in the essence of imperial behavior, namely governing other societies against their will. A new term really is needed, and the term empire is also inaccurate because the United States did not assume this role deliberately, the way most empires deliberately conquer territory. The American role as the world's government is an unintended outgrowth of policies that were adopted for quite different reasons during the Cold War and were extended and expanded in the wake of that conflict. Well, third, the term government is, I think, appropriate and helpful as applied to American foreign policy because that term tells us something important about other countries. Specifically, it explains why, despite all of the criticism we hear about the United States from all around the world, there has been no direct, effective opposition to American foreign policy from other major countries. Opposition that such countries could certainly mount if they chose to do so. The kind of opposition that countries facing powers as mighty as the United States in the past have mounted. Why have they not done so? They have not done so, I believe, because, despite what they sometimes say, they do not feel threatened by the United States, and because, perhaps tacitly, they recognize the benefits they derive from the services that the United States provides. Well, there's a fourth and final reason that I've chosen in this book to apply the term government to what the United States does in the world, and that is, I believe the term is accurate. That is to say, the United States provides to the rest of the world some, although certainly not all, of the services that governments customarily furnish within the countries that they govern. So let me say something about those particular services. First, the United States helps keep order in the world. And keeping order is, of course, the first duty of government. By some accounts, the reason that government is established in the first place. The United States helps keep order internationally and does so in two ways that I think are particularly noteworthy. The first way is what I call reassurance. The American presence in East Asia and Europe relieves the countries of those regions of anxieties about their neighbors that they would otherwise feel, anxieties that their neighbors might threaten them. American forces suppress those anxieties. The American military presence in East Asia and Europe, therefore, serves as a kind of buffer, a pacifier. You might even call us the babysitter of those regions. The American philosopher Woody Allen once said that 90% of life is showing up. Well, 100% of reassurance is showing up. It's the mere presence of American forces that reassures other countries. And that means that this global governmental service is invisible and all but unrecognized, but important nonetheless. The second security service that the United States provides the world that I think is particularly noteworthy is that this country has undertaken major responsibility for resisting what is, I think, generally regarded as the greatest threat to international security in the 21st century, namely the spread of weapons of mass destruction, and by that I mean nuclear weapons, to rogue states or terrorist organizations. Now, it's true that how the United States goes about trying to stem the tide of nuclear proliferation is controversial. American policies toward Iran, North Korea, and of course Iraq are the subjects of controversy. But even those countries that criticize these policies most severely tend to agree that the goal of stopping nuclear proliferation is a worthy and necessary one, and even these countries assume that it is the United States that will take the lead in doing so. I believe that the Iraq War can be seen as an example of the United States resisting nuclear proliferation, and I'll be happy to say more about that. I do discuss it at some length in the book, and I'll be happy to say more about that if there is interest in our question and discussion period. But let me now move on to the second set of services that the United States provides the world. These involve the global economy. In the global economy, as well as for international security, the United States does some, but not all of the things that governments do within the countries that they govern. The United States provides a service that I call enforcement. Within countries, government enforces contracts and generally provides the confidence without which commerce cannot take place. The United States does this on a global scale. For example, the American Navy patrols the world's two most important trade routes, the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. Enforcement for the global economy is like reassurance for international security. It's vital, but also invisible and all but taken for granted. Well, the United States also supplies the world's most frequently used currency, the dollar. Working through the International Monetary Fund, especially in the late 1990s in East Asia, the United States has acted as the lender of last resort for the international system, just as central banks do within particular countries. The United States also performs the function for the rest of the world that the English economist John Maynard Keynes said governments should carry out in times of economic downturn. That is to say, supplying investment and consumer demand to the rest of the world. The United States has been for the last decade the principal engine of global growth and in general has served as the world's consumer of last resort. There's one other governmental service that the United States provides to the international economy that is, I think, important and worth noting. Just as governments within countries supply what are known as public utilities, namely power and water, so the United States assures a global supply of the world's necessary mineral, oil, by protecting the largest source of oil, the Persian Gulf. This, too, I believe, is a governmental service to the rest of the world. Now, the case for Goliath is not mainly a critical book, it's certainly not a partisan book, but American energy policy is the one area where I believe American foreign policy is least satisfactory, indeed where it does the most harm to the world. And again, I'd be happy to discuss that in our question and discussion period. But let me turn now to a question that obviously arises from my analysis. And that question is, if the United States is so benign, if we do such great things for the world, why are so many people so angry at us? Why, to use a phrase that's become common over the last several years, do they hate us? Well, I devote an entire chapter of the case for Goliath to explaining the seeming paradox, and my explanation begins with the observation that hatred, I think, is really not the right word, at least for most of the rest of the world. The world resents the United States, and resents the United States because it is powerful. After all, nobody loves Goliath. Other countries harbor anti-American sentiment as well, out of fear of what the United States might do with the great power that it wields, although not so much fear that other countries are actually moved to do anything to curtail and resist that power. Still, I think negative sentiment about the United States, which certainly predates this administration and the Iraq War, is unlikely to disappear because these sentiments come with the territory and for other reasons as well, which I'll now briefly enumerate. First, American foreign policies, specific policies, are bound to be controversial. They're bound to be criticized, as they should be. Criticism is normal within democracies, and there's no reason that we shouldn't expect it among and between democracies as well. But just as criticism of particular governmental policies in democracies does not necessarily, and indeed almost never, bespeaks a desire to overthrow the system as a whole, so criticism of one or another American foreign policy should not be confused with a general desire to dislodge the United States from the position that it occupies in the international system. Indeed, Churchill once said, that one should never criticize one's own government when abroad or cease to do so when at home. Well, insofar as the United States acts as the world's government, citizens of every other country in dealing with the United States are, in effect, at home. And so, in criticizing the United States, they are merely fulfilling their Churchillian obligation. Second, in some circumstances and in some countries, anti-American sentiment is convenient. The United States serves as a convenient scapegoat for dislocation caused by impersonal forces, such as those generally grouped together under the term globalization, and as a scapegoat for the shortcomings of local governments that wish to shift the blame for what's gone wrong in their countries somewhere else. And the Arab Middle East is, of course, a powerful example of this syndrome. Third, anti-American sentiment has, I think, risen somewhat noticeably in the first decade of the 21st century because there is a special problem with the current administration, especially insofar as Europe is concerned. And this is not because of personalities, but because of ideology. To put it simply, there is no mainstream political party in Europe like our Republican Party. There is no European political party capable of attracting majority support whose core beliefs replicate those of our Republicans, namely assertive nationalism, favoring low taxes and small government, and what we generally call social conservatism, such as advocating the death penalty in certain circumstances. Now, I'm making here not a partisan point. As I say, this is not a partisan book, and it's perfectly plausible to argue that Europeans should be and are becoming more Republican, with a capital R, in their political outlook. One can see some of the economic reforms that are on the agenda of some European countries and perhaps even developing attitudes toward immigration as echoing those that are embraced by the Republican Party of the United States. Rather, I raise this point for analytical purposes. Because Republicans hold different basic beliefs from most Europeans, when Republicans dominate the national government of the United States, as they do today, and do so because they are, by most reckonings, a majority party, this makes the United States, in political terms, look distant, even alien to the Europeans. And the United States looks all the more distant and alien without the common cause of the Cold War, opposition to communism and fear of the Soviet Union that bound the two sides of the Atlantic together during the Cold War. And the United States seems all the more powerful and all the more alarming, at least potentially, because this country is so powerful. Well, a fourth and final reason for anti-American sentiment, or at least a reason that the United States is never going to get the recognition and appreciation that the services I argue it performs in the world would seem to entitle it, is that if other countries actually acknowledge this American role and the benefits they receive from it, they might come under some pressure to begin to pay for it. That is to say, acknowledging the United States as the world's government would risk other countries' status as what economists call free riders. A free rider is an individual or a group who gets something for nothing, and we all recognize that this is an arrangement that no one will lightly abandon. In general, therefore, as I say, this anti-American sentiment, which waxes and wanes according to what policies the United States is carrying out at the moment, but never disappears, comes with the territory and will not disappear as long as the United States plays this role as the world's government, which raises the final question that I address in the case for Goliath, namely, how long will this role continue? Well, the rest of the world, I believe, won't do anything to stop the United States from acting as the world's government, but neither are other countries likely to do anything appreciably to help the United States carry out these governmental duties. And this, I believe, is true even, perhaps especially, of the European Union. a large, wealthy, and ambitious grouping of countries that once were the most important and powerful in the world. The European Union and some of its national leaders certainly talk about a global role, but they don't really play one. This is most obvious where the use of force is concerned. Once the great powers of the planet, the largest European countries now have tiny military forces and quasi-pacifist public attitudes toward international conflict. They just can't be counted on to wage war. But the European abdication of a global role is true even in non-military areas, and even in areas where the Europeans are vocal about their desire for leadership. It's true, for example, on the issue of global warming. The European performance in reducing the emission of greenhouse gases is certainly better than that of the United States, but that's not much of a standard. And even by some measures, the United States is actually doing better. And in any event, by any objective standard, the European performance, despite the fact that they are the architects of the Kyoto Protocol, which is supposed to deal with the problem of global warming, the European performance is unimpressive at best. And the European underperformance is also true in another area about which the Europeans talk a great deal. Indeed, what they say is the greatest problem facing the planet, namely global poverty. They do no more to alleviate global poverty than the United States, and in some ways, especially where agricultural protectionism is concerned, they do a lot less. Europe is, in short, inward-looking. It's parochial. Now, the fact that Europe cares mainly, almost exclusively, about Europe is not to be sneezed at. Europe is an important part of the world, and the European achievement since World War II in building this remarkable economic unit known as the European Union and establishing a zone of peace on what was once the bloodiest part of the planet is not only remarkable, but extremely valuable. Valuable for the United States, because we don't have to come and bail the Europeans out again, and valuable in the long term for the rest of the world, because Europe does act as an important example, a model to be emulated. Europe, that is to say, does, as the Europeans say, do the world a favor simply by existing. But beyond the borders of Europe, the Europeans do very little, and I don't see much chance that they will do more. American foreign policy would certainly be more complicated, but I believe that the United States and the rest of the world would be better off if Europe actually fulfilled much of its rhetoric and became an important global presence comparable to the United States. But I don't see this happening in the foreseeable future. Therefore, or one implication of this, is that the unilateralism that the United States is sometimes said to practice, the go-it-alone policies for which the United States is criticized by so many in other countries, comes about as much by default as by choice. Now, unilateralism is a problem not because other countries are likely to rise up, band together, and oppose the American role as the world's government, but rather because the American public may tire of paying for this role. The actual price of acting as the world's government is relatively low for the United States, and the reason for that is that no major government actively opposes the United States. This means, for example, that the American defense budget, as a fraction of the overall budget and of gross domestic product, is now something like half what it was during the Cold War. The lack of opposition, the lack of active opposition by other countries, acts as a kind of subsidy for the American role as the world's government. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is destined to continue, because on the horizon loom substantial and mounting competing costs in the form of the explosion in entitlement spending that is inevitable as the baby boom generation, that is those Americans born between 1946 and 1964, begins to retire. That will surely squeeze the American taxpayer. That will make the choice between guns and butter, between funding foreign policy and keeping domestic commitments, more problematical and more controversial than it has been at any time since the United States re-entered the international arena in a major way and on a permanent basis at the end of 1941. If Americans come to believe that they have to make a choice between guns and butter, if they believe that they cannot afford both to pay for Social Security and Medicare and to sustain the world, to sustain their role as the world's government, they are, like most people, absent a pressing, serious, urgent international threat, likely to choose domestic politics. They're likely to choose butter over guns. If this should happen, if the United States should reduce its role in the world, the result would be not better global governance, but less of it. And that would make for a less secure and less prosperous world. In that case, I believe that even the harshest critics of the United States would be unhappy. Even those who declaim most loudly against this powerful American role in the world would be unhappy at its eclipse. What will happen? What the American public will decide? How the American role as the world's government will play out as the 21st century unfolds, I think, is simply unknown. What is known, what is clear, what can be stated with confidence at this point, and this is my final point, is the attitude the rest of the world will adopt toward the American role as the world's government. They will continue to criticize it, they will not pay for it, and they will miss it when it is gone. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for a bravura performance. I mean, really thrilling. You're putting so many things that we know into context. And I have three questions right off the bat. Only three. What steps would the outside world take if it were truly, seriously opposed to us? China, not mentioned. And the third, I've forgotten.
It's like the Schleswig-Holstein problem, of which Bismarck said only three people have ever understood it. One is dead, one went mad, and I have forgotten. What would other countries do? Well, I think we know what they'd do because we've seen it in the past. They would form what international relations specialists of a certain persuasion call a counter-hegemonic coalition. The Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, the Japanese, and everybody else who felt threatened would join together formally and would start spending more money on defense. There's absolutely no sign of that. And as I say, the reason is they're not worried. And they're right not to be worried. They should be worried not about a more powerful, but less powerful America. But if you read some of the literature of international relations, which I don't necessarily recommend, you will find people predicting precisely what will happen, predicting new alliances, new alignments, new pacts, new arms races. No sign of that. But that surely is what would happen if other countries felt genuinely threatened. China. Well, China is often touted as the rising competitor to the United States, the early 21st century version of Wilhelmine Germany at the beginning of the 20th century, experiencing rapid economic growth, searching for its so-called place in the sun, feeling that it deserves greater power and perks. That may yet happen in the course of the 21st century. I do not see it happening in the next 20 years, and I sometimes say that the case for Goliath comes with an implied 20-year warranty. Nothing I say can be held good after 20 years because things change too rapidly. I don't believe that China is likely to be a serious competitor to the United States anywhere outside East Asia, if there, in the next 20 years. Chinese will have an increasing global presence. We see them going around the world trying to lock down supplies of energy. But I don't think that China will attempt seriously to disrupt this American role for the next two decades.
Thank you.
What happens in America to dithering sort of abdicates its role as a hegemon and doesn't do what it should do
The Middle East is one, as you all know, one of the most problematical regions in the world, and the United States, for all the criticism that it receives, has done a number of very important things for in the Middle East and for the Middle East. It has assured the continuing supply of oil, which is necessary for the global economy, and incidentally, if the world's oil supply should be shut off or shut down severely, everyone would suffer. But those who would suffer most are the poorest people in the poorest countries, because what will happen is that the price of oil will get bid up even farther, and countries that don't have a lot of money and aren't all that flexible simply won't be able to adjust and adapt. That means that the American role as the sentry in the Middle East and the policeman and the source of safety for the world's oil supplies, it does benefit American SUV drivers, but it also benefits even more Indian and Chinese peasants, and they are the ones that would suffer if the United States didn't play this role. The United States has also prevented a single power from emerging in the Middle East to dominate all the others, and that is a central goal of all Middle Eastern countries, even though they don't say so. The United States balanced against Nasser during the era of Pan-Arabism. It balanced against Khomeini in the wake of the Iranian Revolution. It balanced against Saddam Hussein when he threatened to dominate, when he occupied Kuwait and threatened to dominate Saudi Arabia. That's a very important service as well. And because of active American diplomacy, the United States has managed so far to prevent a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Should the United States abandon any one of those goals or fail to achieve one of them, the Middle East would be a much more dangerous place, and the people who would suffer most in the first instance would be the people in the Middle East, although my guess is that of all the countries in the Middle East, the one that is likely to suffer least in case, if things go badly wrong, would be Israel, because Israel can defend itself, and Israel is a modern, resilient country, and has the capacity to adapt in a way that the other countries don't.
Third question came to me, I'm pleased to announce. Joseph Joffe just published a book somewhat complimentary to yours. He is the editor of Die Zeit in Germany, in which he basically said the United States would be better off if it provided more goods, criticizing the United States for not providing enough goods, international goods. Could you reply to that?
Yes. I have not read Joe Joffe's book. Actually, the book, I encourage all of you to read the Case for Goliath, and even if you don't read it, to buy it. It makes an excellent gift. But the book that is most comparable, also a very good book, is by Robert Lieber, called The American Era, a very well done book, and does compliment mine. So without having read the book, I can only respond in general. Sure, the world would be better off with more of what economists call public or collective goods, that is, things that are necessary but that individuals won't supply on their own. One can think of things that the United States could do to the benefit of the rest of the world, but I don't think you get the American public to do more, and nobody else is doing anything at all. So my attitude toward both the quality and quantity of the American role as the world's government is expressed in one of the epigraphs to the book, which is from Samuel Johnson, who said of a dog walking on its hind legs what I think one can say about the United States as the world's government, namely, it is not done well, but you are surprised to see it done at all.
part of Jordan's qualitative of America now is shifting in a global security area or economic area by foreign countries, namely Japan and China, increasingly buying our debt. And that's something so-called called the landlord of Facebook. How do you see that as impacting your argument and those forces of global economic security?
Well, it's a good question, and I do go into it in some detail in the book. And the mounting American current account deficit is one of the major features and a worrisome feature of the global economy and of international politics. Let me say two things about that. First, that is an example of the United States acting as the world's consumer of last resort. The reason that the Chinese, in particular, are buying American debt is to prevent an appreciation of the dollar, which would make it more difficult for them to export, which would mean that the export boom in China would tail off, which would mean that they could employ fewer people, especially in the coastal provinces. And I presume that the Chinese government, insofar as it is calculating here, and not simply on autopilot, there's some dispute about that, Chinese government calculates that it needs to keep the export sector growing in order to preserve political stability and its own rule in China. And in order to do that, it needs a relatively robust dollar, so it keeps buying debt to keep it up. This has meant that the United States runs these consistent current account deficits, and of course we have to import capital, either in the form of direct foreign investment or loans, to offset this debt. And presumably that process cannot be infinite. I mean, there can't, you know, the Chinese can't be willing to hold this much debt forever. So the great concern among international economists is that this situation be stabilized and reversed gradually rather than suddenly, because if it happens suddenly, you could get a serious financial problem, not just in the United States, where interest rates could go through the roof, but in the rest of the world, because the United States is so important to the rest of the world. You could get the United States experiencing some version, not obviously an exact replica, of the financial crises of East Asia in the 1990s, or in the late 1990s, or even Mexico in the mid-1990s, where people suddenly rushed to dump the currency for fear that, that the value is going to fall. That's a huge problem, and it is a weakness of the American position. There's no doubt about it, but it comes about because of the global public good the United States provides as the consumer of last resort. The Economist magazine had a cover story about a year ago about the global economy, which is called Flying on One Engine. And that engine is the United States. The United States is the only country consuming. So this is a case where other countries need to take up the slack, and they're not doing it. The Europeans are not consuming enough because of the economic problems that they have. The Japanese have been in a decade-long slump. The Chinese have a policy of exporting, so that they're taking all this money and loaning it to the richest country in the world rather than spending it on behalf of some of the poorest people in the world. That's an illogical and ultimately untenable imbalance. And if it is not handled properly, it could really affect the American role as the world's government negatively. But it doesn't come about simply because of feckless American consumers, although, of course, the fact that the Chinese save so much and we save so little is the ultimate underlying cause of the imbalance.
We save -1% at present.
Yeah.
In other words, older people are consuming more than younger people are saving.
Yeah.
Okay, so you started with a brilliant Churchill quote to sort of line up some of the forces here. I wonder if you could evaluate the Goliath role from another quote whose attribution I forget right now. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we've got a great example here of the Iraq War, which even supporters of the administration like this organization generally. We've overreached, we've had some problems, we all agree. And I wonder if you've considered some system of checks and balances that might be constructive, even in this overall positive framework of global leaders.
Well, that's a good question. What is it that checks the United States if other countries won't do it? And I think there is a very powerful check on which other countries rely and can rely, and that is the American public. I sometimes like to say about some goal that either some domestic interest aspires to fulfill or some international goal that people who are critical of the United States accuse the United States of seeking or being able to achieve. I like to say the only thing that stands between, the only thing preventing the achievement of that goal is democracy in America. The American public will not pay for an empire. It won't pay for lots and lots of preventive wars. It's not even willing to pay for Iraq. So there's an internal check. And I think it's also the case that international opinion means something to the United States, although not as much as other countries think it should mean. But in general, I would say that the American public's disinclination in general to choose guns over butter, and in particular to play anything resembling an imperial role, acts as a very powerful check on what might otherwise seem to be an imperial temptation.
What is your opinion about the coming situation in Europe where you have an aging population and more and more Muslims will be parts of the population because they're increasing birth? The fact that, that Turkey is eager to enter the door. Do you think that at some stage in the future there will be a change in the balance of power in Europe based on Muslimization?
The so-called Eurabia scenario. Well, Daniel really knows much more about this than I do, about the specific issue of Muslims in Europe, which is a huge problem. Let me respond in general about Europe. If you listen to investors, money managers, and managers of global multinational corporations, which I have occasion to do, perhaps there's some in this room, it's something of an exaggeration, but I think not much of an exaggeration to say, you know, these are people who are interested in the economic future. They've written Europe off. You know, Asia is the future, America is the present. Europe, it's like a retirement community. It's gracious, it's well-appointed, it works very well, it's got nice people, but it has no future, by definition. And the two problems are, well, there are three problems. There's the demographic problem, which involves the fact that the population is aging, that most European countries have fertility rates below the replacement rate of 2.1 births per female. And the obvious way to counterbalance that is immigration. We've seen what a problem that is. They have political problems because they have sclerotic economies, because their welfare states are too generous. They have too much regulation, and yet they can't seem to make the changes that every informed economic observer thinks they should make. Witness the recent fiasco in France, where the Prime Minister proposed and the National Assembly passed a very modest reform of the labor law, and people took to the streets and forced its repeal. And then there are economic problems beyond slow growth. There's an argument that I won't go into here, that the euro has actually been a bad thing for Europe because it has enshrined a single monetary policy across the continent, which is overly rigid. That the European Central Bank has taken over German monetary policy, which is no longer appropriate even for Germany. In any event, if you talk to people who are concerned with the way the global economy is going, because that's their business, they're not, I wouldn't say they're even bearish on Europe, they're dismissive. I wouldn't be so hasty to write Europe off, although it does have extraordinary problems. I am not convinced that the Europeans, and especially the three major continental countries, France, Germany, and Italy, which are the ones with a case of economic sclerosis. I'm not sure that they won't manage to make economic reforms which will enable them to resume economic growth, not at Asian levels, but, you know, 2-2.5% a year, which would be enough to keep them going, keep the standard of living rising modestly. And I'm not certain, but here really Daniel's views are much better informed. I'm not certain that they will fail to cope with the problem of immigration, in part because in the last couple of years, in different ways, the individual countries in Europe as a whole have received shocks. They were gliding along on a path that they were persuaded was working. It wasn't working, but they didn't know that until this horrible murder in the Netherlands, until these terrorist episodes last summer in London, which were perpetrated by people who were born, two or three of them were born in the United Kingdom, but of immigrant parents, and they were awakened by the riots in France. So they're only beginning to try to address the problem. I don't know whether they'll succeed, but, you know, these are old democracies with powerful cultures, with smart people. So I don't think that the European future is predetermined and predetermined to be a gloomy one, but there's no doubt that people with money to bet on the European future are betting against it.
I just concur and say no on this last question. There is no reason to write Europeans off. They still have time to make changes for reasons you suggested. I wouldn't write them off. Harry?
Yeah, Professor, conspicuously absent in your presentation and even out through the Q&A have been the two words, United Nations, which, like during this time when it's the budget and other aspects of the institution under attack, likes to say that without the UN, how do we deal with global poverty? How do we deal with global health issues, information technology, not to mention peacekeeping? Is it a ruse or what?
Well, the UN has a potential and potentially useful role to play in the world, but it's a very modest one. The first step in understanding the United Nations is to adjust our expectations. The United Nations is a trade association of sovereign states. It doesn't have the resources that states have, and it's never going to have them, and that limits what it can do. I've said elsewhere that it is no more realistic to expect the United Nations to perform important international tasks than it is to expect the Trade Association of American Hospitals, which has a building in Washington, to perform heart surgery. It can't do it. It's not going to be able to do it. The UN has, and the UN's role in global poverty, as far as I can tell, is not only modest, but modestly negative. That is, without the UN development program, the world might be modestly better off, although if it disappeared, it probably wouldn't make any difference. But in serving as a forum and in serving as a legitimating organization, it does have a role. Had the United Nations formally blessed the war in Iraq of 2003, it would have been better, and maybe the United States would have gotten somewhat more international help, although not much more. And in my view, the Europeans said, when we came to them after the war and we said, give us some help, they said, well, we were against the war, so we're not going to help you. In my view, they were against the war in part because they didn't want to be asked for help, because they don't have much help to give. So even with a unanimous United Nations vote, I'm not sure that there would have been the kind of coalition and burden sharing that we would have liked to see. But nonetheless, it's better to have the UN than not have it. And it does have a modest role to play. But as far as global governance is concerned, and this is a point that I argue at some length in the case for Goliath, it's not a candidate.
And what about a trade association of democratic states?
Well, you know, I'm not, I don't object to forming one, but the problem, I mean, the reason that the Europeans have not been deeply engaged in Iraq is not because we don't have a formal association. We have, you can have a coalition of the willing, you can have an ad hoc coalition, we've got NATO. The reason is that they're not doing anything outside Europe. So the real issue is the provision of resources for global governance. That's a matter of political will, and that isn't going to be changed by having another letterhead to add to the mix.
Steve? Yeah, the U.S. question, I can't help but come back to what I was asking about. I mean, yeah, it's easy to push them around. Things falling apart in 40 years. But look at the difference between the outcome when the U.N. approved the Persian Gulf War, very obvious choice to make, and then laid a huge diplomatic defeat at the feet of the United States by not approving the Iraq War. No checks and balances, results in overreaching. And the public basically changed their mind in the meantime.
Actually, the second Iraq war, I believe, was more popular in the United States than the first one at the outset. And the reason that this Iraq war is unpopular is because of cost. There's a very good book about the first Iraq war called Policy and Opinion in the Gulf War by John Mueller, political scientist at Ohio State. He's probably the greatest expert on public opinion and foreign policy. And he looked at all of the polls bearing on the first Gulf War in 1990 and 1991, and he concludes that had the war gone on only a little longer, and had the cost and casualty been only a little higher, support would have fallen off. So the decision not to go to Baghdad was crucial in that war having been regarded in retrospect as a success in the United States. Now, it's true that there was much greater international support, and that made a difference. But I think there were two reasons for greater international support. One was that Saddam did the world a favor in 1990 of committing something that is now rare, and that is a clear violation of international law. He violated an internationally recognized border and occupied another country. That was very common until the 20th century. It was how World Wars I and World War II began. If you think about all of the conflicts since 1945, I can't think offhand of any of them that qualifies as being an unambiguous violation of international law, but because it was a violation of international law, everybody could join in. Second, this was at the tail end of the Cold War, so the habit of cohesion and solidarity was present, except that Mikhail Gorbachev was in charge of the Soviet Union and went over to the other side, and that was regarded as so miraculous that it helped form this global coalition. And third, while the coalition was indeed effective and significant politically and also economically, I believe that the United States actually made money on that war. Look who did the fighting. It was the United States and, to a lesser extent, the Brits. So even in the most favorable possible circumstances, the heavy lifting, the fighting and the dying, was done by the United States. And those circumstances are not likely to be replicated. That is, such favorable circumstances are not likely to come along in the future, all of which is meant to reinforce my point. The United Nations is useful. It's good to have the United Nations on the side of the United States. The United States will always be better off with the United States, having the United Nations than not having the United Nations in anything the United States does. My point simply is we shouldn't get carried away. We shouldn't have any illusions about how much better it would be to have the United Nations.
And with that, I'm distressed to note it's 1:30. Fascinating. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.